The following message was delivered on Sunday morning, May 6, 2001, in the Adult Sunday School class at the Trinity Baptist Church in Montville, New Jersey.
Now, as we come again this morning to our survey of the Old Testament, we will pick up our study around 1100 B.C., near the end of the time of the rule of the judges in Israel. Now, in our previous study, we looked at that 350-year period of time between the entrance of the children of Israel into Canaan and the time of the end of the judges. That period recorded in the books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. That period of time between about 1400 B.C. and 1050 B.C. In the book of Joshua, having taken possession of the land to the east of the Jordan River, under the leadership of Joshua, the children of Israel crossed the Jordan from their camp in the plains of Moab and established a new encampment at Gilgal. And from that base camp in Gilgal, they defeat Jericho. Then they move up into the mountains to Ai and Bethel. And then they defeat a confederacy of southern Canaanite kings. Following their conquest of the land in southern Canaan, most of which was given to the tribe of Judah, the Israelites then moved into northern Canaan. And they defeated a northern confederacy of kings led by King Jabin of Hazor. So they moved from the plains of Moab, across the Jordan River, defeating Jericho, Bethel, and Ai, most of what later came to be known as Judah, moving up into the northern part of Canaan, defeating a confederacy of kings in this area. So in the book of Joshua, we have a record of the conquest and the division of the land of Canaan among the Israelites. In the book of Judges, the next book we looked at, after the death of Joshua and the elders who ruled Israel with Joshua, according to Judges 2 and verse 11, that next generation, quote, did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah and served the Baalim, that is the Baal gods, the fertility gods of Canaan. They served the Baalim and they forsook Jehovah, the God of their fathers, and provoked Jehovah to anger, and he delivered them into the hand of spoilers. And the book of Judges is a record of approximately 330 years of such rebellion and God dealing with that rebellion. And in the book of Judges, we have a record of a number of cycles in which Israel would rebel against the clearly revealed will of God. In response, God would bring an enemy against them who would oppress them for a period of time. Then out of desperation, they would cry out to God for deliverance from their oppressor. God would raise up an Israelite to defeat their enemy and then be set up as Israel's judge to rule over them. Following the death of that judge, Israel would again rebel against God, and God would bring another oppressor against them, and the cycle would start all over again. The book of Judges is a record of 330 years of such cycles, with the book ending with a summary statement describing the climate in Israel in those days. Judges 21 and verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And it is in this context, during the latter years of the judges, that we find the account recorded in the book of Ruth, material we also considered in our last study. Now this morning, seeking to survey the Old Testament as much as is possible in a chronological manner, we come to the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. So please turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 1. Now, in the Hebrew Old Testament, the records we now call 1 and 2 Samuel were originally only one book. When the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek at around or about 200 B.C., this one book was divided into two. But for the sake of our study, we are going to look at it as it really is, and that is one continuous narrative. Now, as for the time frame of the book of Samuel, the book begins just before the birth of Samuel and ends late in the reign of David. So what we have recorded here in 1 and 2 Samuel covers about 130 years. With reference to the book of Judges, when we come to 1 Samuel chapter 1, we have backtracked about 50 years, even though nothing is said about either Eli or Samuel in the book of Judges. Eli would have died just about the time when Samson came onto the scene, and Samuel would have been a young man during the judgeship of Samson. So as we now come to the book of 1 Samuel, we have now backtracked about 50 years with respect to the time of the end of the book of Judges. Now, as far as a broad outline of the book is concerned, I have noted that outline on the board from verse 1 of chapter 1 of 1 Samuel through the middle of verse 1 of chapter 4, we find Eli and Samuel at Shiloh. From verse 1 of chapter 4 through verse 17 of chapter 7, we have a record of Israel's war with the Philistines, at least one of the wars with the Philistines. From chapter 8 and verse 1, going all the way through the end of 2 Samuel, we find what I'm calling the early monarchy in Israel, with chapter 8 of 1 Samuel being Israel's request. Then from chapter 9 through the end of 1 Samuel, we have the reign of Saul, and then 2 Samuel is dedicated to the reign of David. Now the book of Samuel opens by telling us that an Ephraimite man by the name of Elkanah, a man who had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah, that Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And the record tells us that each year this family came from their city of Ramah to worship and offer sacrifices to God at the tabernacle, which at that time was at Shiloh. Shiloh is here, Jericho being here. Shiloh is up in the hill country. Ramah is down in this area. So they go each year from Ramah up to Shiloh to worship God at the tabernacle. Now this particular year, Hannah was very troubled because of her barrenness. A part of the reason for that was the hurtful remarks that Peninnah had been making to her. Apparently it was her practice every time they went up to the tabernacle to dig Hannah a few times about her not having any children. So at this particular season, Hannah was very troubled about her barrenness. And as Hannah was in the tabernacle praying and weeping about this situation, she made a vow to God. Look at what is recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 11. And she, that is Hannah, vowed a vow and said, O Jehovah of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid and remember me, and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a man child, then I will give him unto Jehovah all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. Now that language sounds very much like the vow of a Nazarite described back in Numbers chapter 6. In Numbers chapter 6, in verse 1, we read these words. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When either a man or woman shall make a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself unto the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. Verse 5. All the days of his vow of separation, there shall be no razor come upon his head. He shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow long. It seems that Hannah has these words in mind here in 1 Samuel chapter 1. Now, as Hannah is praying, the priest Eli sees her lips moving, but hearing no words, he assumes that she is drunk. But when she explains that she is not drunk, but only praying because of her sorrow, in verse 17 of chapter 1, Eli says this. He says to her, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him." And we all know the story from there, how Hannah conceived, and when her son was born, she called his name Samuel. Verse 20, "And it came to pass when the time was come about that Hannah conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of Jehovah." So Hannah had requested this male child from God. So she names this male child, "Hear from God." Shama means to hear. El is an abbreviated form of the word "from God." So she names him Shama El, "Hear from God." She is simply saying, this child is a response from God to my prayer. Now we know from the record that Hannah keeps Samuel with her in Ramah until he is weaned. And at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 1, she fulfills her vow and takes Samuel back to Eli at Shiloh. Verse 26. "And she said, O my Lord," here she's speaking to Eli, "O my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by you here praying unto Jehovah. For this child I prayed, and Jehovah has given me my petition which I ask of him. Therefore also I have granted him to Jehovah. As long as he lives, he is granted to Jehovah." And beginning in verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 2, we have a record of Hannah's prayer on that occasion. Then in verse 11 of chapter 2, she leaves Shiloh and goes back to Ramah with her husband, leaving Samuel with Eli in Shiloh. And the only other things that we hear about Hannah are that she visits her son Samuel each year as the family comes up to Shiloh to worship, and that in addition to that, God grants her three more sons and two daughters. Now, as we come to 2 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22, we find a prophecy of judgment coming upon Eli's house because of the sins of Eli's sons. Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are priests at Shiloh. In 2 Samuel 2, verses 12 through 17, we are told that they have been threatening the worshipers in order to get the choice cuts of meat from the sacrifices. The priests were allotted certain portions of the meat from the sacrifices, but they were threatening the worshipers in order to get a particular cut before the meat was boiled. Verse 17 we read, "And the sin of the young men was very great before Jehovah, for the men despised the offering of Jehovah." So these two young priests, Hophni and Phinehas, could use their place of authority for their own personal gain, because to them the sacrifices which were being offered were of little worth. Their low view of God and their low view of His instituted worship allowed them to abuse their authority. That's what it means when it says that they despised the offering of Jehovah. They considered it to be of little value. In verse 22, Eli hears of the sins of his two sons. He questions his sons. He tells them that what they are doing is not good, but they do not listen to him. In verse 27 of chapter 2, God sends a messenger to Eli. And through this messenger, God reminds Eli of how merciful He has been to Eli's family in the past in calling them to be priests. And He accuses Eli in his relationship with his sons, in the way he has dealt with his sons. God accuses Eli of honoring his sons more than he honors God. And He accuses him of that because he has not dealt with their sins. God says, because you have not dealt with their sins, clearly you honor them more than you honor me. And we need to remember this assessment of God when dealing with our own children. If we are going to be lenient on our children and unfaithful to God, what does that say about us? It says that we honor them more than we honor God. That's God's assessment of what Eli did or what Eli did not do. And then beginning in verse 31, he tells Eli that he will judge his family by causing every male to die in their youth. And this is a judgment that will last forever as long as there are descendants of Eli. And as a sign to Eli, he says, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will both die on the same day, and I will raise up a faithful priest in their place. Now, as we come to chapter 3, we find the call of Samuel. After this prophecy concerning judgment upon Eli's house, we find the call of Samuel, a very familiar story. God coming to Samuel during the night, Samuel thinking that it is Eli calling him. Finally, after Eli tells him that he is not calling him, that it is God calling, God tells Samuel what he has already said to Eli through this messenger, that he will judge the house of Eli as he has said. And notice in 1 Samuel 3:13 why God is going to do this thing. 1 Samuel 3:13, for I have told him that I will judge his house forever. Why? For the iniquity which he knew, because his sons did bring a curse upon themselves, and he restrained them not. Judgment was going to come upon Eli and Eli's household because he did not restrain his sons in their sin. Then the final words of 1 Samuel 3, Samuel grew, God blessed him. After all of these years of no word from God, all Israel knew that God was now raising up a prophet, a spokesman, his spokesman in their midst. Now, as we come into chapter 4 and all the way through chapter 7, we find under our second major heading a record of Israel's war with the Philistines. Now, if you read 1 and 2 Samuel carefully, you will find that there are a number of times when there is conflict with the Philistines. But this one is particularly important. The Israelites lived up in the mountains. This is the high country, this darker area. This is the high country. The Philistines lived down in the plains by the Mediterranean. So the Philistines had the advantage of having flat country to fight on, and they had many chariots. So, for the most part, they had the advantage, at least humanly speaking, when it came to fighting the Israelites. In 1 Samuel 4, the armies of Israel and the armies of the Philistines are facing each other at a place called Aphek. Aphek is in this area. They are camped against each other down in the plains at Aphek. During that conflict, Israel is defeated and 4,000 Israelite soldiers die. Israel decides that what they need is the Ark of God in their midst, the Ark of the Covenant in their midst, so that they will be victorious. So they send to Shiloh for the Ark. So they send from Aphek, which is here, up into the hill country to Shiloh for the Ark, and Hophni and Phinehas bring the Ark down to Aphek. When the Ark arrives, the Philistines are afraid because they think this is Israel's God coming into the Israelite camp. Look at 1 Samuel 4 and verse 7. The Philistines say, woe unto us, for there has not been such a thing heretofore. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all manner of plagues in the wilderness. So being idolaters themselves, they thought this ark was an Israelite god or contained Israelite gods. But in spite of that, the Philistines go to battle anyway. Israel is again defeated. This time 30,000 Israelite soldiers are killed. The Ark of the Covenant is captured by the Philistines, and Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, die. Now, beginning in verse 12 of chapter 4, a messenger is sent from Aphek back up to Shiloh to report on the battle. Eli, at this point, 98 years old, is waiting for some word. When he is told that the Ark of God was captured and that his two sons had died, in verse 18 of chapter 4, Eli fell from off his seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck broke and he died, for he was an old man and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. When the pregnant wife of Phinehas hears the news, she immediately gives birth to a son. And because the ark had been taken, because of the death of her father-in-law Eli and her husband Phinehas, she names her son what we pronounce in English, Ichabod. Literally, Ye Kavod, which means no glory. And she explains that when she says the child name is Ye Kavod, because the glory is departed from Israel. And then she dies. Now in chapter 5, the Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant back from the battlefield at Aphek, back to their own cities. They take it first to Ashdod. So the Ark of the Covenant has come from Shiloh up in the hill country down to Aphek, and now they take the Ark down to one of their cities on the plain, on the coast, the city of Ashdod. Look at what is recorded beginning in verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 5. Now the Philistines had taken the Ark of God, and they brought it from Ebenezer, that is the battlefield, unto Ashdod. And the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon. Dagon is or was the Philistine fish god. They were fishermen living on the Mediterranean, so they had to have a fish god to bless their endeavors. The Hebrew word for fish is dog. So Dagon is the fish god. And they set the Ark of the Covenant by Dagon. Verse 3, and when they of Ashdod arose early on the next day, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the ground before the Ark of Jehovah. And they took Dagon and set him in his place. Let me pause to say that must be very embarrassing for a god to have to be set back up in your place since you can't do that for yourself. But nevertheless, verse 4, when they arose early on the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the ground before the Ark of Jehovah, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands lay cut off upon the threshold. Only the stump of Dagon was left to him. Therefore neither the priest of Dagon nor any that come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod unto this day. Now verse 6. But the hand of Jehovah was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them and smote them with tumors, even Ashdod and the borders thereof. And when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel shall not abide with us, for his hand is sore upon us and upon Dagon our God. They sent therefore and gathered all the lords of the Philistines unto them, and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be carried about unto Gath. And they carried the ark of the God of Israel there. The same thing happened in Gath. The same thing that happened in Ashdod. They were afflicted with tumors. So they send the ark to Ekron. These are all Philistine cities. So the ark has come from Aphek up in this area, down to Ashdod, down to Gath, and over to Ekron. So it is circulating among the Philistine cities in the plain. Now, verse 10 of 1 Samuel 5. And it came to pass, as the ark of God came to Ekron, that the Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought about the ark of the God of Israel to us, to slay us and our people. They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines, and they said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel. Let it not go again, and let it go again to its own place." And you know the story from there. After the ark was in the Philistine cities for 7 months, they gather a council of Philistine priests and diviners. And they advised that the ark be sent back to Israel. Sent back with a trespass offering to the God of Israel so that hopefully he will withdraw the plague from them. That trespass offering was to be 5 golden replicas of the tumors with which God had afflicted them. So whatever these tumors looked like, they made 5 golden replicas of the tumors, one for each of the 5 lords of the Philistines. Also, the trespass offering was to include 5 golden mice. Now, apparently, even though we're not told this specifically, apparently, the Philistines had discovered that God was spreading the plague among them through the rodents. So they made 5 golden mice, and also were sending that back. The offerings, one for each of the 5 lords of the Philistines, was to be placed in the ark sent back to Israel. Now notice what these Philistine holy men say, beginning in verse 5 of 1 Samuel 6. "Wherefore you shall make images of your tumors, and images of your mice that mar the land, and you shall give glory unto the God of Israel. Peradventure he will lighten his hand from off you, and from off your gods, and from off your land. Wherefore then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? When he had wrought wonderfully among them, they did not let the people go, and they departed." So they had heard the report of what Jehovah had done to the Egyptians and how God had plagued the Egyptians until they let Israel go free. And their counsel was that their fellow Philistines learn a lesson from the Egyptians. Not harden your hearts, because this God means business and he will continue to plague you until you do what he wants. So that was the advice of these Philistine, these pagan priests. So the Philistines built a new cart, and they hooked up to that new cart 2 milk cows. They placed the Ark of the Covenant on the cart with the trespass offerings in it, and to make sure that these plagues were really the result of the Ark in their midst, because if the plagues were not the result of the Ark of the Covenant being in their midst, they did not want to give away these golden trespass offerings for nothing. So to make sure that these plagues were really the result of the Ark of the Covenant in their midst, they took the calves of these 2 milk cows, took the calves back home, and waited to see what the cows, the mothers, would do. Their assumption was that since these mother cows would instinctively turn to their calves, if they did not turn back to their calves, but rather went off in the opposite direction toward the Israelites up in the mountain, if they did that which was contrary to nature, they would then know that this thing was from the God of Israel. Notice verse 9 of 1 Samuel 6. "And see if it goes up by the way of its own border to Beit Shemesh. Then he shall have done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that is the God of Israel. It is not his hand that smote us. It was a chance that happened to us." Well, sure enough, the cows departed from their nursing calves and went straight uphill from Ekron up to Beit Shemesh. So they traveled uphill in this direction with their calves being behind them. They did that which was contrary to nature. The Israelite men at Beit Shemesh gladly, with rejoicing, received the ark, but because they opened the ark and looked inside, God smote them, that is, the Israelites at Beit Shemesh, with a great slaughter that killed 50,000 Israelites. The ark is then sent further up in the hill country to a place called Kiriath Yeharim, which is just to the northeast of Beit Shemesh, and there it stays for 20 years until in 2 Samuel chapter 6, David brings it back to Jerusalem after he moves from Hebron to Jerusalem himself. Chapter 7 ends with God delivering the Philistines into the hands of Israel under the judgeship of Samuel. Now, as we come to chapter 8, we begin this lengthy section which goes to the end of 2 Samuel, which I'm calling the early monarchy in Israel. In chapter 8, we find, first of all, a record of Israel's request. In the first three verses, we are told that when Samuel was old, this is 1 Samuel chapter 8, that when Samuel was old, he appointed his two sons, Joel and Abijah, judges over Israel. That his sons did not walk in the ways of Samuel, but rather they perverted justice for monetary gain. They would take bribes from the people in order to fill their own pockets. As a reaction to that, the elders of Israel come to Samuel, to this old man Samuel, who they know is not going to be around, or they suspect is not going to be around much longer. They come to Samuel in light of what his sons are doing as their judges with a request. In the words of 1 Samuel 8 and verse 5, they say, "Make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Now this request displeased Samuel. Samuel understood that Jehovah was the ruler. Jehovah was the king in Israel. Israel was a theocracy. That is, God was their king. But now they wanted a monarchy, a human king like the other nations. Well, Samuel takes this request to God, and in verse 7, God answers Samuel with these words. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 7. "And Jehovah said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not be king over them, according to all the words which they have, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto you. Now therefore, hearken unto their voice. Howbeit, you shall protest solemnly unto them, and shall show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them." So God says to Samuel, they want a king, give them a king. But make sure to tell them what that's going to cost them. Make sure to tell them that. So in verses 10 through 18, Samuel tells Israel what this king is going to cost them. He is going to bring all of your sons into the army and send them off to battle and have them killed. He's going to take your daughters to be cooks and wives and cleaners and all kinds of things like that. He's going to take your property. He's not going to do anything for you that God is not already doing, but it's going to cost you with him while it's not costing you now with God. In verse 18, he concludes his description of their king by saying this, "And you shall cry out in that day because of your king whom you shall have chosen you, and Jehovah will not answer you in that day." Is that what you want? That's what God will give you. But when you come back complaining, God will not hear you. But in spite of these warnings, verse 19, "But the people refused to hearken unto the voice of Samuel." So God says to Samuel, make them a king. So beginning in chapter 9 of 1 Samuel, we have the reign of Saul. Now apparently, according to the record, Saul was a very handsome young man. 1 Samuel 9 and verse 2, speaking of the son of the Benjamite, Kish, and he had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Now, I would especially call the attention of you young ladies to this description. And a later description of David's son, Absalom. Real hunks on the outside, but wicked and ungodly on the inside. Don't assume, because a young man is pleasing to look at, that he will be pleasing to live with. Here are two examples of that very principle. In chapters 9 and 10, Samuel anoints Saul as Israel's first king, and Saul returns to his home in Gibeah, that is just north of Jerusalem. In 1 Samuel 11, the Ammonites threaten the Israelite inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead. So Saul is in Gibeah here. The Ammonites, who live over in this area in the desert, have now threatened the Israelites living on the east side of the Jordan River in Ramoth Gilead. The inhabitants of Ramoth-Gilead send a message to Saul in Gibeah, telling Saul of their plight. And growing out of that, Saul then calls together Israel. Actually, he threatens Israel. He threatens them that if they do not come together to help their brethren in Jabesh-Gilead, that he will destroy all of their herds. But he brings together Israel, they go to Jabesh Gilead and defeat the Ammonites. Growing out of that military victory, Saul, who has already been anointed by Samuel, has already been pointed out in a limited context by Samuel as their first king. Saul is now officially made king down in Gilgal, just across the river from the plains of Moab. Notice in 1 Samuel 11, and verse 14. Then said Samuel to the people, "Come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." And all the people went to Gilgal, and they made Saul king before Jehovah in Gilgal. So Saul is now officially Israel's first king. In 1 Samuel chapter 12, following the installation of Saul, Samuel gives a very solemn address to Israel. It reminds us of the final words of Moses and later the final words of Joshua. Samuel reminds Israel of what God has done for them throughout the centuries, but how they have rebelled against him, how they have not responded properly to what God has done for them. And echoing the words of Leviticus 26, Samuel tells them that if they obey God, God will bless them. But if they rebel against God, that God will be against them. Notice what is recorded in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 12. Samuel says to the people, after making this address and pleading with them to be faithful to God, he says in verse 17, "Is it not wheat harvest today? I will call unto Jehovah that he may send thunder and rain." It did not normally rain during time of harvest. "I will call unto Jehovah that he may send thunder and rain, and you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of Jehovah in asking you a king." So Samuel called unto Jehovah, and Jehovah sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared Jehovah and Samuel. Now, when the people hear these words of Samuel and see this miracle, they plead with Samuel to pray for them. And Samuel assures them that God is not going to destroy them, and he again reminds them, if you will and your king will obey God, God will bless you. But if you rebel against God, God will judge you. In 1 Samuel 13, war again breaks out with the Philistines. From a human perspective, things do not look good for the armies of Israel. The Philistines come with 30,000 chariots. 30,000 chariots. The Philistines also had the advantage of having weapons, that is, spears and swords of iron, and Israel had none. because at that point in time, Israel was somewhat under the thumb of the Philistines, and the technology to make and to sharpen iron was withheld by the Philistines from the Israelites. If they even wanted a plowshare sharpened, they had to take it to the Philistines and get it sharpened by them. So at this point in time, the Philistines had 30,000 chariots and weapons of iron, and the Israelites had neither of those. In preparation for this battle, Samuel was to come to the Israelite camp in Gilgal and offer a sacrifice to God. When Samuel does not show up when he had promised, then Saul offers the sacrifice himself. Well, Samuel soon arrives and confronts Saul. Saul tries to justify what he has done, of course. And in 1 Samuel 13, in verse 13, Samuel says to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of Jehovah your God, which he commanded you. For now would Jehovah have established your kingdom upon Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. Jehovah has sought him a man after his own heart, and Jehovah has appointed him to be prince over his people because you have not kept that which Jehovah commanded you." Here is a prophecy of the kingdom being taken from Saul and given to David. In chapter 14, God brings a great victory over the Philistines in spite of Saul's sin, but he does this by the hand of Saul's son, Jonathan. In 1 Samuel 15, we find that familiar account of Saul being sent as God's instrument to seek vengeance against the Amalekites. You remember when Israel departed from Egypt many years before, the Amalekites came out against Israel down in Sinai and sought to defeat them. The record of this encounter with the Amalekites is found in Exodus chapter 17. Now, with God's help, of course, the Amalekites were defeated. But at that time, God said to Moses in Exodus 17 and verse 14, "Write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." So because of what they had done, God says, their day is coming when I will wipe them out. Well, the time has now come for that to be fulfilled. And Saul is to be God's instrument to do this. Saul is given instructions to go against the Amalekites. They are here at Gilgal. He is told to go against the Amalekites who are all the way down in the Negev Desert. In northern Sinai, he is told to go against the Amalekites to destroy all them. Not one person is to live, not one animal is to live. When Saul returns, he has spared Agag the king, and he has spared the best sheep and the best oxen. As God's spokesman, Samuel again tells Saul, "Because of this, God will take the kingdom away from you." And at that point, Samuel departs and never comes back to see Saul again. In the next chapter, in chapter 16, Samuel comes to Bethlehem and anoints David to be king in Saul's place. Now, Bethlehem is here just south of Jerusalem. Bethlehem is here. So Samuel comes from Ramah up here down to Bethlehem and finds David and anoints David as king in Saul's place. From that day, we are told that the Spirit of God came mightily upon David and the Spirit departed from Saul. And in the providence of God, very soon after that, David becomes Saul's armor bearer. Remember, he becomes Saul's private harp player in the time of Saul's distress. And it is at this point that conflict then begins between Saul and David. In chapter 17, we find the familiar account of David killing the Philistine champion, Goliath of Gath. This happens in the valley of Elah. So we have the Israelites again doing battle with the with the Philistines down in the Philistine plain, the valley of Elah between Soko and Azekah. It is at this point that David slays this Philistine champion, Goliath. From this point, a friendship develops between David and Saul's son, Jonathan. But Saul becomes more and more jealous of David because David is receiving praise from the people more than Saul is. Verse 9 of 1 Samuel 18. And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. From this point, when David seems to be getting more recognition than Saul, and Saul eyed David. And of course, that means he eyed him with evil intentions. In chapter 18, Saul makes David a captain over 1,000 soldiers and sends him to do that which he hopes will get him killed. In chapter 19, Saul calls upon his servants and upon his son Jonathan to kill David. And this begins a period which lasts most of the rest of 1 Samuel, in which David is fleeing from Saul. In chapter 19, he flees to Samuel up in Ramah. Samuel has come and anointed him. Of course, he knows Samuel. He's fleeing from Saul. He goes to where Samuel is. In chapter 20, he makes a covenant with Jonathan, Saul's son. In the early part of chapter 21, David flees to a place called Nob, N-O-B, just to the north of Jerusalem. Nob is in this area. He flees to Nob, and there he approaches the priest Abimelech. You will remember that Abimelech gives him, because he is hungry, a showbread to eat. He gives him Goliath's sword that he has been keeping. But this scene is viewed by a man by the name of Doeg, Doeg the Edomite, and he reports to Saul what has happened, and in a very short period of time, Saul comes with his soldiers and kills all the priests of Nob because they have befriended David. Then in the last part of chapter 21, David is so desperate that he flees to the camp of his enemies, the Philistines. He flees to Achish, the king of Gath. Now remember what Gath is. Gath is that Philistine city down in the Philistine plain that was the home of Goliath. So David is so desperate that he flees to the place which was the home of the Philistine champion that he himself had killed. And of course, because of that, they recognize him. Notice in chapter 21 and verse 13, it is said of David, and he changed his behavior before them, and feigned himself mad in their hands, and scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. David was pretending to be insane. He was so afraid of Saul that he fled to one of the worst places he could flee, but the only choice that he had at that point in time. But he was afraid there as well, so he assumed if he acted like a crazy man that they would spare him, which they did. The Philistines believed that he was insane. They assumed that he would have to be insane to walk right into the city of this great hero of the Philistines that he had killed. Notice what King Achish says in verse 14. One of my favorite Old Testament passages. I think I would have liked this man Achish. Then said Achish unto his servants, this is after David has pretended to be insane, behold, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Don't I have enough crazy people without you bringing me another one? That's what he's saying to them. In chapter 22, we find David has moved away from the city of Gath, again back up in the hill country, and is now hiding with his men in the cave of Adullam. In chapter 23, even though he is fleeing from Saul, he is still fighting the Philistines there in the hill country of Judah. In chapter 24, he moves over from the cave of Adullam, which is in this area. He moves over to a place near the Dead Sea called En Gedi, a spring near the Dead Sea. And all of these movements he is seeking to keep ahead of Saul, who is after him. In chapter 25, still on the move, he has his encounter with Nabal there in Maon, which also is just up above the Dead Sea in this area, where he meets his future wife, Abigail. In chapter 26, in that same area, he is hiding in the wilderness of Ziph. In chapter 27, David goes back to the Philistines. He says in verse 1 of chapter 27, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me and seek me any more in all the borders of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand." This time he also goes to King Achish in Gath, and Achish gives David the city of Ziklag to be his own city. It doesn't say exactly why Achish did that. It's a mystery, but nevertheless, Achish gives, who is in Gath, gives David the city of Ziklag, which is down in this area here. So he gives David this city in the foothills of the mountains there near where he is. From here, David and his men make raids against Israel's enemies, while all along telling King Achish, the Philistine, that he is making raids against Judah. Achish likes that, of course, and that helps him retain his city in Ziklag. In chapter 29, the Philistines are now preparing to again go to battle against Israel. David asks King Achish for permission to go fight for the Philistines. Of course, he's not going to fight for the Philistines. He's going to fight for Israel. But he asked permission to go along and help the Philistines. But the lords of the Philistines are suspicious of David, and his request is denied. When David then returns to Ziklag in chapter 30, he discovers that the Amalekites, who live to the south of him down in the Negev, have raided Ziklag from the south and have taken all the women and the children and have burned the cities. So he pursues the Amalekites to the south and rescues their families. So from chapter 19 of 1 Samuel all the way through chapter 30, David has been fleeing from Saul as Saul has sought over and over to kill him. David has had plenty of opportunities to kill Saul, but he has refused to touch the one that God has placed in authority over him. When we come to 1 Samuel 31, the Philistines and the Israelites are doing battle up in the Jezreel Valley, up in this area here. They are doing battle in the Jezreel Valley. The advantage, of course, is with the Philistines because that is flat ground and they have the chariots. And even though David wanted to be there in order to help his countrymen, because of the jealousy of Saul, he is 120 miles to the south, rescuing his family from the Amalekites. Israel is defeated. The sons of Saul, including Jonathan, are killed up on Mount Gilboa, which is here. Saul himself thinks he's going to be killed as well, so he attempts to kill himself. The book of Samuel ends with Israel, the book of 1 Samuel ends with Israel going down in defeat, and the body of their first king, Saul, fastened to the city wall at Beit Shan, later recovered by the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead. Remember Jabesh Gilead, up in this area that Saul, in the early part of his reign, came up to help against the Ammonites. When they find out that his body is nailed to the city wall in Beit Shan, they come over and take his body and bury him. Now, since the Hebrew Old Testament includes 1 and 2 Samuel in one book, just as we would expect, 2 Samuel picks up right where 1 Samuel leads off. David is still in Ziklag, having just returned 2 days earlier from pursuing the Amalekites and rescuing the wives and children of his men and himself. An Amalekite man comes to Ziklag from the battlefield up north in the Jezreel Valley. So the battle is over. This Amalekite man comes down to Ziklag reporting about the battle. He tells the man that Israel, or he tells David, the man tells David that Israel was defeated. Saul and Jonathan were dead. When David inquires as to how this Amalekite knows these things, the man tells him that he happened to be coming by where Saul had impaled himself on his own spear, that Saul requested that he finish taking his life, that he had done what Saul had requested, and now he was bringing Saul's crown and Saul's bracelet to David. At this report, David and his men wept for Saul and for Jonathan and for Israel. And he asked this young Amalekite man a question which he himself had taken very seriously in recent days. Notice in 2 Samuel 1 in verse 14. How were you not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy Jehovah's anointed? God had set this man apart to be king over Israel. Why were you not afraid to kill such a one as that? Well, we're not told what this young Amalekite man said, if anything, because in the very next verse, we find a record of David calling one of his young soldiers to fall upon this man and kill him. The remainder of 2 Samuel 1 is David lamenting for Saul and Jonathan. In 2 Samuel 2, David asked God if he should now go home to Judah. And God tells him to go up to Hebron. So he's down in Ziklag. God tells him to go up into the hill country to a place called Hebron. Notice in verse 4 of 2 Samuel 2. The men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. So God tells David to go up into the hill country to Judah, and the inhabitants of Judah anoint him as king just over that one tribe in the south. We're also told in 2 Samuel 2 that Abner, the captain of Saul's armies, had made Saul's son Ishbosheth a king in Israel, that is, the northern tribes and the tribes to the east of the Jordan River. In addition to that, in chapters 2 and 3, we find a record of some skirmishes between the followers of David and the followers of Ishbosheth, Israelites fighting among themselves, with a summary statement being found in 2 Samuel 3 in verse 1. Now there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David waxed stronger and stronger, but the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. Now after David was king of Judah in Hebron for 7.5 years, in chapter 4 it is recorded that Ishbosheth, the king in the north, Saul's son, was assassinated. And just as the Amalekite soldier was killed by David for having taken the life of Saul, the two men who assassinated King Ishbosheth, when they came to David with the head of Ishbosheth, thinking that they would be rewarded by David, they were told the story of how this Amalekite young man was killed for taking the life of Saul. Immediately after that, David commanded that they be killed. Why? Because they had laid hands upon God's anointed. Then in 2 Samuel 5, all Israel comes down to Hebron after Ishbosheth is dead and makes David king over Israel. Then David, defeating the Jebusites here at Jerusalem, David moves his capital from Hebron up to Jerusalem. Chapter 5 ending with David defeating the same Philistines who had so easily defeated Saul 7.5 years before. In 2 Samuel 6, we find a record of David bringing the Ark of the Covenant from Kiriath Yeharim up to Jerusalem. The last word that we heard of the Ark was when the Philistines had taken it. Remember, during the battle down at Aphek, the Philistines had taken it. It circulated through their cities, and they finally gave it up because of the trouble they were experiencing, and it had been in Kiriath Yeharim for now 20 years. David brings it back to Jerusalem. Now, as we come to 2 Samuel 7, we come to a very important chapter. It is David's desire to build a temple for God in Jerusalem. After the prophet Nathan has given him an initial green light, God then sends Nathan back to David to tell him that instead of David building God a house, God was going to build David a house. Notice in verse 11 of 2 Samuel 7. Moreover, Jehovah tells you that Jehovah will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you shall sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you that shall proceed out of your loins, and when I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Here is the inauguration of the Davidic covenant. Then beginning in 2 Samuel 8, we find a record of some of the victories of David. His defeat of the Philistines, his defeat of the Moabites, the Syrians. In chapter 9, we find his kindness to the only remaining descendant of Saul, Mephibosheth. In chapter 10, his victory over the Ammonites. Then beginning in chapter 11, David's defeats. In chapters 11 and 12, his grievous sin with Bathsheba, his murder of her husband Uriah the Hittite. Finally, Nathan's parable of the little ewe lamb and his reproving of David because of these sins. In chapters 13 through 19, David's defeat in dealing with his own family. You will remember that following his sin with Bathsheba, God's spokesman Nathan told him that the sword would never depart from his house. And in these chapters, we find that prophecy being fulfilled. Amnon raping Tamar, Absalom killing Amnon, Absalom seeking to take the throne from David, the death of Absalom at the hand of Joab, and then the book of 2 Samuel coming to an end with yet another war with the Philistines in chapter 21, David's psalm of praise for God delivering the Philistines into his hands in chapter 22, the song of David in chapter 23, and in the final chapter, David numbering the fighting men of Israel and God sending pestilence as a judgment. Well, brethren, that's a very quick overview of what is recorded in 1 and 2 Samuel. A lot of material in a very short time. But now our time is gone, and our prayer is that God will use this brief flyover to help us in days to come when we will seek to study these particulars in more detail. Let us pray. Our Father, we are thankful that you have given us this privilege to take this brief look of this record of your dealing with Eli and with Samuel, with Saul and with David. We ask our Father that you would help us to learn lessons from your dealings with these men that we will be able to apply to ourselves as we seek to serve the same God. Be merciful to us and help us. In Jesus' name, amen.